Honored for his service to the crown. All of that, yes. But fallen. His honor erased. For those who didn't know, one glimpse of the slave brand on the back of his hand would be enough to reveal him. The skin remained tight where the mark had been burned into his flesh. But even when all remaining discomfort had vanished, it would still burn him. He felt as if the brand was some kind of beacon, drawing attention, declaring itself. Slave or not, Queen Phila had commanded him to go and attack the temple with the city guard, and he had done as she'd instructed, even wearing a guard uniform. Many had been killed before they'd been driven back, and now that his mission had failed, he expected repercussions. Had Phila given her loyalists orders to take his life should he fail? Or had she given them those orders regardless of his success? He marched toward the far side of the bridge, waiting for the death blow. They could mark him with any scar they liked. Now that he had freed himself, he would never be enslaved again. A knife in the back would be better. At least then he would have died free.
"What are we doing?"
Thistle rasped low, nudging closer to him in the cluster of city guards. Deimos glanced over his shoulder, but Commander Curtness seemed almost to have forgotten his presence. Curtness barked at his men, looked up at the palace, and then back toward the temple, and hurried them onward.
"Quiet until we can speak alone," Deimos whispered to Thistle. "On your life."
The sailor tugged at his blood-spattered beard and fidgeted with his hands. They'd taken away his sword, unwilling to trust a sailor of the queen because they'd found him inside the Temple of Four. Thistle had spoken only the truth, that Admiral Hollardi had sent him with a message for one of the novice priests. But this had made Commander Curtness more suspicious than ever. Why a priest? What had the message contained? Thistle claimed not to know the answers to those questions, and perhaps he did not. But Curtness clearly did not believe him. Deimos had taken up his cause, insisting that Thistle was loyal to Admiral Hollardi and thus to the crown, and that he must be speaking the truth. Curtness had let him live, but planned to put him in a cell until he could be questioned further. The commander had always struck Deimos as a fair man, and he seemed more than a little conflicted over the chaos reigning in Lartha today. But he would follow the queen's orders no matter what. That much was clear. And it made him very dangerous to Deimos and Thistle at this moment. The sky churned with dark clouds, and a cold wind blasted between the city's hills, sweeping in and around them, rushing above and below the bridges, whipping at flags and bending trees. Rain had just begun to fall, lightly at first, but with the promise of much more to come.
"There they are!"
one of the guards shouted. Their pace quickened, a dozen men and women hurrying across the bridge. At the far end where the bridge met Palace Hill, a detachment of city guards awaited them. Four clusters of perhaps 40 each, standing in orderly rows. Deimos had seen such formations many times before, and he knew what he was looking at. Assault units, ready to be deployed. Thistle began to speak again, and Deimos hushed him with a single glance. This was not the time for questions to be spoken aloud. With each of the four units were two silent assassins, swathed in gray, their postures making their intentions clear. They were no longer meant to hide in shadows. The queen had sent them out into the capital to kill.
"Commander!"
called a sergeant as he stepped out from the nearest formation. Deimos recognized the sergeant as Connell, the friend who'd snuck Mirren in to see him when he'd first been arrested. Apparently, the young city guardsman had been promoted.
"All guard units are in position, awaiting the signal, sir,"
Connell reported. Curtness, still nursing bloody wounds and bruises, joined Sergeant Connell.
"Take two units back to the Temple of Four," the commander ordered.
"Right away, sir."
"Send the other two units to Yaris Teeg. Be aware, they have Phage on their side, and a priest who commands
magic."
"Magic?" Connell asked. "Dangerous, powerful, but it must be confronted. Some of the priests will hide in the tunnels, but do not pursue them there. Seal the entrances and set a watch. Queen Fila's edict is in effect from this moment. Accept every surrender, but execute anyone who refuses to swear fealty to her.
Sergeant Connell's face went pale.
Anyone, Commander. What of the Apex? Especially the Apex,
Curtness snarled.
If you can get close enough, kill her on sight. The Queen will give an island to the guard who brings her Euphraxia's head.
Deimos felt his gut roil as he watched some of the guards roar their assent. To their credit, some also seemed uneasy, but none of them were willing to disobey. In moments, the four units were passing them, rushing back along the bridge the way they'd come, and it was clear that this had been part of the plan all along. If the initial assault failed, it would be enough to distract the priests who were loyal to the Apex and allow them to think themselves triumphant. But now Sergeant Connell took four times as many guards with him as had been part of the first attack. The priests would never stand against them for very long, not even with magic on their side. The phage might even the odds, but the silent were a counterbalance. The priests would either surrender, or they would be massacred. Thistle tapped Deimos's shoulder.
Look there.
In the distance, smoke rose from two hills, the ancestral homes of Clan Hartshorn and Clan Docklin. Nearer still, they could see fire blazing from a block of merchants' homes just a few hundred yards away, on the road back up toward the palace.
Apparently they did not await the signal, Commander Curtness said grimly. Let's move. We're to join the sweep of the courtier's district. Every household must kneel.
He looked pointedly at Deimos and Thistle.
Every soldier and sailor must take up the sword for the Queen, whose orders have been conveyed through me. There is a chain of command, Thistle argued. And the Queen is atop that chain. Her word supersedes any other, Curtness said.
He patted one of his guards on the back and then gave the woman a shove to get them all moving.
Don't be afraid to get your blades bloodied. You won't make it through the night without killing, so get it through your heads now.
They began to troop past Deimos and Thistle, these 10 men and women who'd been among Curtness's most trusted guards. The commander took a step nearer to Deimos and locked eyes with him.
You have something to say, Calistrate?
I'm not going with you.
Neither is Thistle.
I've given you an order.
Deimos smiled and cocked his head.
Queen Fila ordered me to accompany you on the assault at Yaris Teague, and then to return to her, and to Princess Mirren. You've just said that the word of the Queen supersedes any other. Unless you believe that you're an exception, I'm sure you'll agree that my duty is to obey her instructions.
Commander Curtness glanced at Thistle, eyes narrowed. He might have argued, but just then the bells in the Bone Spire began to ring. White and fluted, like an enormous musical instrument, it stabbed the air above the palace, half the height of the Blood Spire, but far more beloved because of its bells. That changes today, Deimos thought, because he saw the way the guards around him stiffened. The Bone Spire would not be beloved anymore.
I take it that's the signal your guards were supposed to be waiting for, he said. Go. Curtness said. But you don't go alone.
He grabbed the shoulder of one of his soldiers, a monster of a man, arrogant but skilled, and not half as dumb as he looked.
Coughlin will see that you return to the palace.
Coughlin knew better than to argue, though he seemed disappointed, as Commander Curtness led the others away at a run, the bells still pealing. The wind picked up, and with each gust the sound of the bells grew louder and softer. Coughlin wiped rain from his eyes and shot a pointed look at Deimos and Thistle.
Let's move. Faster the better, the ugly guard said. Don't be stupid, and we'll all get where we're meant to be tonight.
He grinned at Deimos.
Some of us to warmer beds than others, I'd wager.
Coughlin indicated that Deimos should lead the way, with Thistle between them. And they started up the hill into the shadow of the palace and the pouring rain. At the first blind corner, still half a mile from the palace, Thistle sprinted away,
Coughlin shouted furiously and ran in pursuit. Deimos cut the large man down before he'd taken his third step. Thistle hurried back to him, the two of them staring for a moment at the blood mixing with the rain that sluiced around the cobblestones in the road.
"Free to talk now?"
Thistle joked, as he bent to retrieve Coughlin's sword for himself. Deimos started walking, still toward the palace.
"Say it quickly, old friend. Mirren awaits and decisions must be made."
Thistle began talking, and with every word Deimos felt his heart lighten. It did not entirely surprise him to learn that Admiral Hollardi had brought a fleet that even now made its way up the River Susk. But the news kindled a powerful hope within him. Today was a dark day in Lartha, and the people would be both terrified and revolted by Fila's actions against the Temple of Four in the Apex. And even though the common folk probably hadn't harbored any thoughts of rebellion before this, if Daria truly meant to make war upon the queen, to take the city from the crown, she would certainly find willing allies among the furious and the oppressed.
"I never dreamed it would come to this," Deimos said, quickening his pace.
"There's more. A bit of a shock, really," Thistle noted.
"It's about the Admiral."
Deimos slid against a wall, peering around a corner. The gates of the palace were guarded, of course, but he'd been sent out with Commander Curtness, and he wore the cloak of the city guard. Mirren would be waiting for his return just inside the gates as they'd agreed, unless Fila had ordered her confined to her chambers.
"What about her?"
Deimos asked, as he moved around the corner and started toward the gates.
"She's Bajuman."
"That's not funny."
Thistle grabbed his arm.
"I'm not laughing."
Deimos faltered. Then he saw in the other sailor's eyes that he was not jesting, not at all. A shudder went through Deimos, and for a moment he felt a familiar revulsion. Then he thought of Maus and Tolliver and his own childhood, the Bajuman executed and banished these past weeks, and the woman he'd fought beside. The woman he'd followed. Daria Hollardi was one of his dearest friends. More than that, she'd been his leader. In every battle he'd fought under her command, he'd hoped for her approval. And though the initial shock had torn through him with speed, this news changed none of that.
"Her eyes," he began.
Thistle held up both hands.
"Don't ask me. I haven't got the whole story, but I promise you it's true."
"And the fleet still follows her,"
Deimos said in wonder.
"Most of us, not to mention thousands of Bajuman in a parade of little boats that shouldn't even have made it through the waters of the ring. But they follow nevertheless."
Deimos imagined a string of small boats full of rebellious Bajuman slaves, following a fleet of warships led by a Bajuman admiral. Laughter bubbled up inside him, and he had to let it out. His smile grew so wide that it hurt his face, but he hung his head, trying to force himself to breathe and to quiet his laughter.
"What's so goddamned funny?"
Thistle asked, staring at him with such concern in his eyes that it caused a fresh wave of laughter.
"All of it," Deimos said, catching his breath.
He wiped at his eyes.
"It's lunacy, my friend. The world is upside down. It doesn't matter to you that she's Bajuman?"
That sobered him.
"People are being slaughtered all over the city because they won't kneel to a queen who will kill anyone who doesn't share her every cruel whim. Today, I find that nothing matters more than that."
He turned his hand so the brand was clearly visible, reminding Thistle that he bore the mark.
"As for following a slave, who am I to argue?"
He put one hand on the pommel of his sword and started for the gates.
"I wish Daria hadn't kept her secret from me, and I look forward to seeing her again. I believe in her mission, but my only concern is finding Mirren and getting away from here. I've dreamed of a life with her since we were children, and I won't abandon that dream now."
"That seems the coward's way out."
Deimos spun on Thistle. "I don't care what you think, but you have never been a slave. You have never seen your father torn apart in front of you, or had your family murdered for a lie. You can do what you want,
but don't think for one second you can judge me.
They stared at each other for a moment before Fissel nodded, and they moved once more toward the palace. As the rain pelted them and the sky grew darker, a wagon raced through the square in front of the palace gates with a wild-looking bearded man at the reins. Two city guards on horseback pursued him as objects tumbled out of the back of the wagon, lanterns and pottery and clothing. Small hands appeared, hurling things. A family attempting to escape execution, using their worldly possessions to defend themselves. Deimos quickened his pace, thinking to aid them, but Fissel took his arm and he remembered what he'd just said. Hundreds would die in Lartha today. Perhaps thousands. But Deimos's duty was to Mirren. The hooves of the guards' horses clattered on wet cobblestones. Deimos wondered how long the family had spent packing, and realized that they'd planned to evacuate the city long before the city guard had begun their house-to-house sweep. Maybe he had underestimated the unrest in Lartha. The people were terrified and ready to flee. Or to fight. The palace gates lay ahead. There were no supplicants to the throne lined up now. The usual guards were there, now with reinforcements. The small guardhouse could not have held the 9 men and women who were standing sentry, and their number made Deimos's spine stiffen. Could he and Fissel kill this many? Certainly not, which meant they had no choice but to talk their way inside. Mirren would be waiting on the other side of the gate, ready to command them if she could choose the right moment to intervene, if she knew when he would be there. If. This seems poorly planned on your part, Fissel said quietly, as the 9 gate guards saw them coming and began to react. If those guards had been dogs, they'd have begun to bark at the approach of 2 soldiers they did not recognize. Instead, they tapped one another and put hands on their swords. One woman drew her blade. Deimos could not argue with Fissel's criticism. When a small hooded figure moved out from the shadow of the northern palace wall, they all ignored it at first. A peasant who'd been hoping to make an entreaty to the queen and was unafraid of the rain, or so Deimos thought. So he imagined they all must have thought. But when that small, slim figure marched toward him in Fissel, the gate guards stared in suspicion. 2 of them broke away from the gate and began to follow the hooded one, who quickened his pace. Fissel began to draw his sword. No, Deimos said. He's a friend. For he'd seen inside that hood, and he knew the pale face within. Tolliver, he said quietly, just loud enough for the boy to hear him above the rain.
You were supposed to wait for us.
No more time for waiting, the boy said, walking right past them. Follow me, Deimos, you and your friend. And if those bastards at the gate follow, you'll have to kill them.
What is this now?
Deimos thought, but he followed, and Fissel did the same. Over his shoulder, he looked at the guards and called out,
We'll see what he's up to. Commander Curtinus sends orders to stay to your posts. It's begun now, and no doubt there will be those who try to rush the gate to reach the queen.
The 2 guards who'd set after them looked unsettled and uncertain. They faltered a couple of steps and then consulted quietly before starting back toward the gate, glancing around as if afraid that at any moment the populace might attack the palace. Deimos was now beginning to think this a very rational fear. Tolliver led them half a block west to a small alley of shops, most of which had been shuttered. Several still had people rushing in and out, but word had spread quickly, and they knew the city guard and soldiers were on the way. One woman saw Deimos in his cloak and screamed. She toppled the cart of fruits and vegetables she'd been trying to drag inside her shop and fled within, screaming for someone, perhaps her husband. The cloak had helped them before, but now Deimos thought it would work against them. As Tolliver quickened the pace, Deimos reached up to unclasp the cloak. When he glanced up again, the boy was gone.
Here, Fissel said, seeing his confusion.
They glanced around. A handful of worried faces were watching them, so there was no chance of slipping away unnoticed. But Deimos saw no other option and followed Fissel into a small theater. He glanced back at the doorway, but it seemed none of those out in the alley were brave enough to follow. In the darkness of the foyer, with the sound of the rain outside the door, Tolliver stood between curtains that draped the entrance into the theater proper. A hand touched the boy's shoulder, and he stood aside. And then she emerged from behind him.
Mirren,
Deimos said, hurrying to her, the clasp of his cloak forgotten. Her eyes gleamed in the darkness, alight with determination.
You were meant to wait in the palace, what—
The palace isn't safe now, not even for a princess. The time's come for us to leave, she said, glancing warily at Fissel.
He's a friend, Deimos said, introducing him. We've fought together before.
Mirren nodded. Tolliver heard whispers on the street, out among the peasants, of a fleet coming up the Susk to challenge Fila.
We know. Daria Hallardi's in command.
A smile touched his princess's lips. Well then, by all means, let's go and greet her. Deimos removed the cloak of the city guard. They were leaving Lartha behind at last, chasing their dream of the future, and he preferred not to be killed by his own allies in a case of mistaken identity.
All we have to do is live until tomorrow, he thought.
Mirren took his hand and led him deeper into the theater. An old man, perhaps the owner, bowed to the princess as they passed by, and then he retreated backstage. They made their way into a cellar with Fissel and Tolliver in tow, then into a tunnel, down a set of stone steps, and by the time they surfaced half an hour later, they were nearly at the bottom of Palace Hill, and only blocks from the river. In the gray storm light, with the rain pouring down, they made their way to a boathouse. It was clear that Mirren had been here before and was prepared for this day. The boat wasn't much, but the hull didn't leak and the oars were strong, and Deimos and Fissel had been rowing all their lives. They'd make it to the fleet. They had to. Blaine felt Daria's approach, as if it were midwinter and his soul yearned for spring, knowing it was coming, but impatient for its arrival. He was angry with her, nurtured an ember of fury in his heart. And yet he'd read the words she'd written over and over. Daria. This was Daria. His sister was still alive. His rage existed alongside the joy of that thought and the urgent ambition that had propelled him for years. His sister had returned, and she had returned with an army. Apex Euphraxia wanted him to broker an alliance, and perhaps that would serve Blaine for now. But if the queen could be overthrown, and if Blaine might seize even more of the magic he had watched Fila wielding, had wielded himself, then he knew he would no longer need the Apex. His dream of freedom for the Bajuman would be made true. Pleasure rippled through him, though he wasn't sure if it was the thought of freedom or the magic inside him. The falling rain merged with the sparkling blue in the air, and he smiled. This was the fabric of the world, and he felt as if he could almost touch it, unravel it, weave it into whatever pattern he wished. Once he had believed in no gods at all, but now he could almost imagine what it might feel like to be a god himself, a Bajuman god. The idea made him laugh before he caught himself short. Don't be a fool, he thought. You're only a man with a little taste of the miraculous. And yet Blaine was growing to like the idea of the miraculous. It seemed like a miracle that Daria was still alive, and even more of a miracle that he found himself here, with this power, and an alliance with the Apex of the Faith engaged in two wars against the Queen, one war for the people, and one for the magic of gods. He ran alongside the river, leaving Temple Hill behind. His heart felt tethered not to the Temple of Four, but to Yaris Teague, and he wondered how Jemmy fared. He could remember the way her lips tasted, and the way her skin felt beneath the roughness of his hands. Blaine hoped to see her again, and he hoped if that day came, they would find themselves on the same side. Across the river, he saw smoke rising from a dozen places in the city. Despite the rain, two fires burned so furiously that their glow could be seen against the gray sky. If there were screams, the river drowned them out. At the market bridge, he saw merchants lowering boats toward the water. There would be more soon. Most would not think to flee, assuming their past loyalties would not be called into question, that the city guard would treat them with decency and a sense of justice. But there would be those among them who would have heard whispers about the behavior of the queen and taken them seriously, and some of those would no doubt try to escape the city. Some would attempt to leave by the roads, but the smart ones would take to the river, which made things difficult, because Blaine needed a boat. He peered across the river through the rain and decided that a nearby merchant's boat would do perfectly well. Whispering a prayer to Daphne, he reached out to touch the magic that fell with the rain, flowed with the river. Nothing more than a shadow on the riverbank, he stepped into the water and waded up to his knees. Then he heard a voice off to one side, words carried by the wind. He looked up river and he saw another boat, this one nearer to him. Four passengers, one of them tall and dark-haired and rowing powerfully, not content to let the current carry them toward the sea. "This'll do even better," Blaine thought, and he spoke his prayer a little louder. His eyes closed to slits, and he breathed deeply. As he let out that breath, he felt the magic of the gods flow through his heart, from his lips, from the tips of his fingers. The water around the boat rose up and carried it toward the riverbank in a wave. The rower swept his oars, stabbing comically at the water while the rest of them tried to hang on. Another man and a woman tumbled into the river a dozen feet from the bank. Flailing, a young boy leaped after them. Only the rower held on as the wave delivered him and his boat to the riverbank, shoving it ashore. Wide-eyed with shock, the rower stood and drew his sword while his passengers swam toward the bank. The boat rocked beneath the rower's boots as he stared at Blaine, and then the man's eyes widened. "I know you," the man said, stepping from the boat onto the riverbank, sword held firmly as the others dragged themselves from the water behind them. Blaine muttered the beginning of a prayer to Charin, and fire blossomed in the palms of his hands, and then he realized that he recognized the other man as well. "Oh, this is a gift," he said. "The four have blessed me. You were there at the temple, helping the city guard murder my friends. You're one of Fila's dogs." "I have no love for Fila," the man said, eyeing the fire in Blaine's hands warily. "Nor any loyalty to her. She had my father murdered and my mother and brother died because of her. Clan Calistrate has been torn apart. And that was only the beginning." "Deimos Calistrate," Blaine thought, remembering the name. "Cast down into slavery." "Yet you fought for her," he said. "You killed for her." The woman who'd been on board his boat pulled herself out of the water behind him, followed by the boy. Deimos held up a hand to prevent them from coming any closer, as if distance mattered for Blaine's powers. The woman ignored him and drew her sword, apparently more than willing to die at Calistrate's side. Soaking wet, her hair plastered to her cheeks, she looked somehow familiar. But Blaine could not place her.
"Yes, I did. And you killed for Euphraxia," Deimos said. "She's as corrupt as the queen."
Blaine heard shouting and looked across the river. The merchants had gotten their boat into the water, reminding him that there would be others. He wanted to reach Daria as quickly as possible, before he could get lost in the midst of an exodus.
"Step aside, Calistrate," he said. "I have need of your boat. If you're running from the city, you might die today. But it doesn't have to be at my hand."
"Your high order," the woman said. "With that kind of magic, how can you desert the faith now? If you hate the queen, the priesthood needs you. The four need you.
The Bajamin need me. And that's all that matters.
Blaine let the fire burn higher in his hand. It rose into a spiral, whipped by the wind, a tornado of flames in his palm. He felt as if he could paint the sky with it and knew he could kill them all.
Stop!
Please, the boy said, stepping past the woman, and for the first time Blaine saw that he was Bajuman. He faltered. No, he thought. He wouldn't kill this boy. Enough Bajuman blood had been shed, and more would surely be spilled in the process of trying to bring freedom to them all. But he had to get to Daria, and they had what he needed. The fire in his hand dimmed, but only a bit.
Get out of the way. I must have that boat.
Then the other man rose from the water, staggering, and drew his sword as he stepped forward.
Enough talk. You can't have the fucking boat. Let's see what your goddamned magic can do.
Blaine could only stare at him.
You. Your Fissile. The messenger my sister sent.
Fissile lowered his sword as if all the strength had gone from his arm.
Blaine?
Deimos Callistrate did not lower his sword, but he did begin to laugh.
Wait, he said, glancing at Fissile. You're telling me this asshole is Daria's brother?
You know Daria?
I served under her, Deimos said. She's who we're going to see.
The fire went out in Blaine's hand. Everything was different after that. Chapter 19. Before any skirmish or full-blown battle, Daria was used to having Char close at hand to help her prepare. Not just laying out her weapons and uniform, helping her dress, checking the clasps on her armor and tightening the straps and belts that kept her weapons close to her body, but also as her sounding board, confidant, and sometimes the voice of reason and calm. Daria had never faced a conflict with fear in her heart, because for her, every new day was another day of a life she should never have had. The real Daria had died upon hitting the sea below those cliffs, and this new version was a blessing from Lemuria. Yet the absence of fear did not mean she had not contended with doubts and worries. Char had always been there to help with those. He was dead now. He'd loved her in secret. And then he'd hated her. The memory of his sneering disdain echoed bitterly in her thoughts, and Daria felt his absence keenly. But as her fleet moved up the River Susk and toward Lartha, it was not Char who occupied her thoughts. With the greatest battle of her life facing her, all she could think of was the face of a small boy, and how that boy might look now as a man. I'm going to see you soon, brother, she thought. And although so much heaviness weighed on her mind, she could not help smiling.
Admiral, Gree asked. Your orders.
She could hear the concern in his voice.
Yes, Captain, she said. Send the runners on ahead to scope out the land. Though we're rowing upriver, I can't help thinking we're rushing into this.
I'm not sure delaying would benefit us at all, Gree said. You heard what the lieutenant said. Things are moving on a pace in Lartha, and any element of surprise we have, we must use.
Daria nodded and looked around the table at her ship's captains. None of them disagreed, and they had all signed their names to the battle plan she had drawn up. She appreciated the trust in that, but also knew that the truth was obvious to them all, both from experience and from the complex situation they were about to immerse themselves in. No battle plan ever survived the first clash of swords.
No sign of Fissile? She asked.
Gree shook his head.
Tell me when he returns, she said. Anything else?
She looked around the table at the men and women facing her. Grim but confident, she sensed no trace of doubt in her leadership, only in their situation. They were sailing to a possible war against their queen. No sane person would not be troubled by that. No one spoke up.
There is one more thing, Daria said.
She stood, smiled, and felt a surprising heat behind her eyes.
She was not normally an emotional woman. This was not a normal time. Thank you. For everything that has happened, and all that's to come. We've fought some real battles together, and we have always been bound by trust. I'm honored. That still remains, and it feels stronger and more precious to me now than ever before. I know that we're facing genuine uncertainties today, but I'm convinced we're doing the right thing. We're standing true to our convictions, and I firmly believe that we are upholding our duty to Qandis, first and foremost. I love this land as much as you all. I love its people, Qandians, and Bajuman alike. And I love you, for— She did not finish her sentence. She didn't need to.
Captain,
a sailor said, knocking at the open wardroom door.
A small boat's approaching, and Thistle's on board.
Thank you, Daria said. She turned to her officers. Captain Gree with me. The rest of you, dismissed. Make final preparations for the liberation of Lartha. Gree left first, and she followed him out of the wardroom and up onto the deck. The wind blew rain into her face, stinging her skin and narrowing her eyes. She was nervous. Had Thistle delivered the message to Blaine? More importantly, had he returned with a reply? Many scenarios were swirling in her head. Blaine could not be found. He was allied with the Queen. He was lost in the chaos of what Lartha had become. He was dead. He hated her for what she had done. She actually wasn't sure which of the last two would hit her harder. Daria's heart thumped and her skin tingled with anticipation of whatever news Thistle might bring.
Stand to,
she heard from amidships.
Who goes there?
She saw a group of sailors at the gunwale aiming crossbows down at a boat that was out of sight. Beneath the shush of the wind, she heard the boat nudging against the Nyadin, and Thistle's voice as he offered a response.
Seaman Thistle from the Royal Dawn,
he called up.
With me I have Princess Mirren, seeking to ask Admiral Hilardi for sanctuary. Deimos Callistrate, next in line for the Callistrate Baronhood. A Bajuman boy, Tolliver. And Blaine, brother of Admiral Hilardi.
Her heart pounded, and she could not stop the smile that touched her lips. He's here. Not a message. He's come to me in the flesh.
Let them on board, Captain Gree said.
He glanced back at Daria. It might have been the first time she'd seen anything like disapproval in his eyes. She tried to vanquish her smile, but could not. Instead, she offered him a small shrug. Yes, she should have told the captain, but this had been a personal affair. She had feared her revelation might be met with anger and resentment, that Blaine might never forgive her. Yet here he was, and with him somehow was the sister of the Mad Queen, her old friend and comrade in arms, and a Bajuman boy. Daria waited away from the railing while the passengers from the boat came aboard. Crossbows had been lowered, but she could still sense her sailor's alertness and caution. The princess came first. Captain Gree bowing his head in welcome, Princess Mirren hugging her robes tight against the wind and rain. Daria was surprised to see that the royal wore a sword, and she wondered what was going on in Lartha that warranted this unexpected appearance. She glanced behind the princess to see a young Bajuman boy come next, wide-eyed and fascinated. Then Deimos, her old friend whom she'd started her journey back to Qandis to save. He stood at attention and saluted, and Daria returned the salute half-heartedly. Deimos reached to shake her hand, and she clapped him on the shoulder, told him how glad she was to have him back, how sorry she was about his family. The words were sincere. Deimos meant a great deal to her. He'd been her brother in arms, but Blaine truly was her brother. And the anticipation of his arrival distracted her from what ought to have been a more enthusiastic reunion.
I wasn't sure if you'd come back, she said, squeezing Deimos's shoulder.
Once you'd learned my story?
Yes, you were.
If all of these sea dogs are standing by you, surely you knew I would do no less.
He released her hand, almost but not quite returning to attention. Then he showed her the back of his right hand, and she blinked in surprise at the slave brand burned into the skin.
Besides, I'm seeing things quite a bit differently these days.
Daria knew he'd been enslaved, but still the brand was a shock.
Was it hellish?
Deimos narrowed his eyes.
Nothing I'd ever complained to a Bajamin about, Admiral.
He leaned in slightly and spoke more quietly.
You could have told me, you know. I'd have kept your secret.
Daria nodded, as if such loyalty was a foregone conclusion, when only 2 days before she could never have imagined the truth would have ended in anything but disaster.
Apparently, you've kept a great many secrets, Deimos added.
He looked back down into the boat, then at Daria once more, and then he stepped aside to make way for a tall, strong man who mounted the top of the rope ladder, ignoring the helping hands offered to him. The young man in his priestly robes had begun to scan the faces on board even before he set foot on deck. When he locked eyes with her, Daria's chest tightened, and shame warmed her cheeks. She wondered what he saw, whether he recognized her, and whether the flood of childhood memories he was experiencing was similar to her own, as warm and comforting.
Blaine, she said,
and he blinked several times upon hearing the name from her lips.
Sister,
one word, but she had longed to hear it forever.
Daria's whole world narrowed and her focus shifted from her cruise, her command, her duty, to lock solely onto her long-lost brother.
She held out her hands and beckoned him forward, terrified that Blaine would turn his back on her and walk the other way. In his eyes, she saw grim uncertainty, and realized Blaine also thought he might still reject her. He had every right. He'd come to this ship, true, but accompanying Deimos and the princess. There were stories within stories, and she desired to hear them all, but right then the only tale she needed was the one between the two of them. To make sure there still was a story between the two of them. That was all that mattered. Abruptly the hesitation vanished from his face. He shook his head with a quiet laugh, then stepped in close and embraced her, his hands clasping behind her back, his forehead resting on hers. This close, she could see how tired he looked, how ill, and yet there was something in his eyes that caused a shiver of fear, a strength, a power.
Daria,
he whispered, voice barely higher than the wind.
Blaine, she said again, enjoying the name on her lips. I'm so sorry.
Sorry?
For everything. For letting my life carry me away from you.
For not finding you sooner. She pulled him closer and pressed her cheek to his, closing her eyes and shutting out the rest of the world, just for a while.
He hugged back.
You only did what I would have done, he said into her ear.
You escaped, took a chance, and—
He pulled back, looked her up and down, then around at the majestic battleship.
You seem to have done quite well for yourself.
Daria laughed, a short, sharp bark that she couldn't hold back.
Admiral, Captain Grease said, we need to be moving.
She blinked, letting the reality around them back into her thoughts. Officers and sailors had awkwardly glanced away to give them privacy, and Daria appreciated that discomfort. Now, though, she focused on Captain Gree again and on the task ahead.
Of course, she said. Give the order, Captain.
Admiral, Deimos said, coming close.
There's so much to talk about.
He glanced back and forth between her and Blaine.
I'm sure, she said.
Deimos, this is Blaine, my brother.
Oh, we've met, Deimos said. The words were spoken with humor. But her old friend also looked afraid.
He was bruised and battered, thin and wasted within his city guard uniform, and in a way he and Blaine looked similarly bedraggled. Once more she wondered just what had been happening in Lartha.
"They know about you?"
Blaine asked, looking around at the crew members who had been watching the small boat's arrival and the reunion that followed. "They know. And we fight side by side regardless," she said. "Considering your arrival, that's fortunate, don't you think?" Blaine shrugged.
"I would have made them understand."
"You would." His eyes flickered from her and he lowered his head. For an instant she thought he was reverting to the usual stance of a Bajuman, looking down in case he accidentally caught someone's eye, and she touched his chin to tilt his face up again. But then she saw that he was looking down at his hands. He turned them palm up, then over again, fisted, and then fingers splayed, and he seemed fascinated. Daria saw Deimos watching, and there was definitely fear in his eyes.
"Deimos?" she asked. "As I said, my friend, there's so much to talk about, and it can't wait. You need to hear it all before any attack is launched."
He glanced around at the other four ships' captains, who were waiting to board dinghies back to their vessels.
"We should include them."
Daria nodded at Gree, and her captain passed the order.
"You've returned to a terrible time," Deimos said.
"It began with my father."
"I know," she said. "It was your mother who first warned me what was transpiring here. She sent an albatross. She set all this in motion," Daria went on, gesturing to the assault force assembled on the river.
"Queen Lysandra's fault," he said. "And now Fila, that raving mad bitch, she's taken the throne and she's even worse than her mother."
Princess Mirren had held back half a dozen steps during Daria's reunions with her two brothers, one by birth and the other by war. But now the royal stepped forward, tall and commanding, eyes flaring with determination, and for the first time Daria saw how it was that Deimos had fallen so completely in love with her.
"Admiral, perhaps this discussion is better conducted in private," the princess said.
"Of course," Daria nodded.
"A war council then, and quickly."
She glanced at Blaine. He was still staring at his hands, as if amazed or aghast at what they could do. And it made her wonder. But she and her brother would have to wait. Before family, there was duty. Before stories of the past, there was war. Standing in the pouring rain and the scything wind in the open square within the Temple of Four, the great towers to the gods rising around her, Fila felt as if her old self had become a stranger. Hundreds of gargoyles looked down upon her as sickness roiled in her stomach and her bones ached. Her muscles felt fluid and weak, and every time she blinked, she worried that she would not be able to open her eyes again. Blood dried on her skin, but she liked its cooling feel. It meant that she was alive. It was not only emergence into the storm that made her feel born afresh. It was her heightened sense of self, of her surroundings, of life. While pains and sickness bit in and made her feel so wretched and wonder whether her ambitions in magic had driven her too far and fast, a deeper part of her reveled in what she had done and in what she was becoming.
"I will be the Eternal Queen," she thought, "rich in power, forged by magic, and Quandis will last for 1,000 years with me on its throne." Even so, sickness spun and throbbed as if it was a living, breathing thing. She leaned forward and gagged, and the spittle dripping from her lips was alive with sparking things.
"Majesty," Per Ristolo said, "please, let me help you."
The old priest was in awe of what they had already done, his wrinkled face given a youthful hue by his fascination. Behind him, Per Stellan looked on in disapproval, robes blowing about her form. But Fila could see the excitement in her too. In all their preparations and rituals with fellow priests over the years, She knew they had never seen anything like her. They had never believed. Perhaps that was their problem. Per Ristolo held her beneath the arms and then lifted, supporting her weight as he guided her toward the center of the foursquare. Fila shivered as the wind cut through her damp clothing, and the sounds and smells of war suddenly became more prevalent. Betika, god of wind and war, watched from her eyes and smiled.
Shom, Fila said. I need to speak with Shom.
You need to preserve your strength for the final ritual,
Per Ristolo said. She knew what he was thinking. She was his queen, true, but now she was also his project. The priest was as eager as she was to discover just how much she could take before breaking.
All of it,
she'd said to them down by the tombs of the four.
I want all of it. Not just those few fleeting tendrils of magic that you priests gather, haul in, keep like wisps on the air. I want it all. And I will not break.
Shom, she gasped, and the silent was by her side. She seemed taller than before. Or perhaps Fila was stooped with the sickness, crushed by the weight of what she bore. For the first time, she saw an expression other than calm understanding on the silent's tattooed face. Shom looked afraid.
You're my right hand, Fila said. You'll be with me forever, my guide and my guard, my protector.
Rain running across her scarred features, Shom nodded once.
It'll be over soon, and everything will be new. Everything will be better. For now, remain by my side.
There was no doubt in Shom's eyes, yet Fila would not have blamed her if she wondered just when it would all be over. And whether something grand and new could really rise out of what was happening here. And not just here, but throughout Lartha and Quandis. For while weakness and sickness battled inside Fila with the magic that promised so much, outside, throughout the Temple of Four and beyond, war raged. Smoke rose beyond the four square walls. Crests of fire blooming from timber and thatch roofs. In the far corner of the square, close to the foot of Charin Tower, several bodies were huddled against the wall, fresh blood spattered across skin both dark and pale. Fila could make out the robes of priests and cloaks of her guard. She felt no flicker of regret. Anyone in the guard knew their lives were owed to the crown. Anyone speaking out against her was to be put to the sword, and she anticipated that throughout the priesthood there would be a great many martyrs today. Let them martyr themselves for whatever cause pleased them, crown or faith. Tomorrow, when the rest of the nation saw what she had become, they would be forgotten. Who needs martyrs when they can have a new goddess? Around the square stood several silent, and a score of city guards, all of them facing the towers and surrounding walls, watching the doorways and arches for any attack from beyond. They had secured the four square, killed any who stood in their path, though many of the buildings no doubt still housed priests, who were even now plotting against her. Fila was not worried. The warriors who fought in her name were alert, confident, strong, and dedicated to their queen. They would deal with whatever rebellion remained. But she was also sure that if any of them did falter, she had the power to defend herself. Soon, she would have all the power, and any skirmishes or squabbles remaining undecided would come to an end. From beyond the walls, farther down Temple Hill, and out of sight, she heard the sounds of combat. Even over the storm, she could hear the clash of steel, shouts, and screams. Perhaps the magic enhanced her senses, and the flickering blue lights, those starry motes in her eyes, connected her to the elements more intimately than before. Regardless, she could hear the dying screams of those who opposed her,
and some who fought for her. And she cared not at all. They were symptoms of change, the inevitable results of her deviating from a norm that had been holding Qandis down and back for generations. Now that she had been imbued so deeply with magic, she had trouble understanding why such power had been rationed for so long. The High Order had much to answer for. They had not even been keeping the magic for themselves, but had been guarding it jealously, ensuring that it fell into no one's hands. Had guarded the people from the very thing that could have helped them. Well, no more.
Peristolo, she said. I'm ready.
Majesty, Perstellan said. The priest remained a dozen steps from her queen. Still she doubts. Fila felt anger boiling, but she had to hold it back.
Perstellan, this will happen, Fila said. I called you in from the ring because I believed in the depth of your faith. Now you can witness, play a part, and share in the results. Or you can be against me.
She nodded toward the bodies in the corner.
And you can see what happens to people who stand against me.
I am neither for nor against, Perstellan said. I am simply loyal to the four.
As am I, Fila said. As am I. Now, the ritual. When can it begin?
Soon, Peristolo said.
You are where you need to be, Majesty, at the perfect point of balance between the four towers and the tombs far below.
So this is the spot. You are certain?
The priest blinked, nervous and uncertain.
This has
never been done, Perstellan finished for him. And I remind you, Majesty, for good reason. Any fault, any error, and the magic might be unleashed in an unhindered storm that could destroy all of Qandis.
Might, Fila said. Could. Where is your courage, priest?
This isn't about courage, Perstellan said. It's about knowing what's right and knowing what's wrong.
I had hopes for her, but Perstellan will have to go, Fila thought. I need her for the ritual, but afterward...
Enough talk, Fila said. Enough fear, enough caution.
Begin.
Peristolo nodded, let go of her arms, and called over those few priests still faithful to the crown, who had remained at the edges of the large square. He started issuing orders. Gather this, fetch that, prepare this, honor that. Fila listened but hardly heard. She did her best to hold down the sickness, withheld any whimpers of pain that throbbed through her. When she was a princess, whispering through the palace and absorbing information and news, patience had been a virtue. Now her time for patience had gone, but she knew she only had a small while to wait.
Majesty, a voice called.
From the corner of the square, Sergeant Connell and two other city guards were dragging a robed figure. He was moaning as he came, feet dragging across the stone slabs and leaving thin trails of blood to wash away behind.
I ordered no prisoners, Fila said.
She knew that this clampdown had to be hard and harsh, a display of power that put down any resistance to her rule once and for all. Prisoners were always a problem. Deimos Callistrate had already proved that, though she'd put his inconvenience to good use.
Persalis, Perstellan said.
Peristolo stopped what he was doing and looked over as the guards dropped the man close to Fila's feet.
What's this? She asked.
He came to the front gate alone, Sergeant Connell said. He says he has information.
Not information. Persalis said. A promise.
A promise of what? Fila asked.
Failure.
The priest hadn't been beaten, so far as Fila could tell, but he had been dragged, perhaps all the way up from Yaris Teeg. She was aware that the first assault on the novice temple had been a failure, resulting in the loss of many city guards and silent, and that an enemy none of the survivors recognized had fought against them. That was unfortunate, because it meant that Euphraxia still lived. Phila was expecting that dog Deimos Callistrate.